You may find this hard to believe, but 60 songs that explain the 90s, America's favorite poorly named music podcast, is back. With 30 more songs and 120 songs total, I'm your host, Rob Harvilla, here to bring you more shrewd musical analysis, poignant nostalgic reveries, crude personal anecdotes, and rad special guests, all with even less restraint than usual. Join us once more on 60 Songs That Explain the 90s every Wednesday on Spotify.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line wearing a Jimenez for President t-shirt, it's Andy Greenwald.
It's not settled. It's not settled.
It's in the courts, baby. What's up, man? Hey, so I just want to say what an amazing job you and Kaya did on the finale recap. I was so sad not to be a part of it as I Anthony Trolloped my way across the continent. I gotta say though, I did try to call in.
It's, you know, true.
I was on the streets of Paris. I had been activated to kill Jason Bourne. I was really looking forward to bringing that spice level to the podcast, but technology, we did not get the new Lucas Mattson update. So I
it
wasn't
was incredible.
Able to,
there was a moment when you appeared Paul Greengrass style. Moments away from launching into either parkour or a brilliant analysis of the finale, but we lost it.
Who knows which one? I'm sure at some point I will share my thoughts on the finale, but today is not that day because we have Jesse Armstrong on the podcast. He was incredibly gracious to give us about an hour of his time to talk about what Succession meant to him and also to break down a couple of very important moments from the finale. Andy, any other useful context people might want for this conversation?
No, I think a couple things. This comes up in the interview, but just, you know, people should be reminded that Jesse also is a proud member of the Writers Guild. He is on strike, but the guild guidance has shifted a little bit. You know, we had Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage on last week as well. The guidance now is that people, and I agree with this, should be free to promote their work, especially, I mean, completed work. Work that was completed before the strike. The ask is just not to engage the machinery of the state to do so, meaning like studio publicists or network publicists. So this, like our interview with Josh and Stephanie, we were very lucky to have it come directly from Jesse, from emailing with Jesse, who's been on with us, I think, after every finale of the show. So that was thrilling. And, you know,
just as a point of order, does that mean that I get to start promoting my Calispatron spec scripts, or is that still kind of like under wraps?
The spec script aspect, I think that you might be stepping on your future success, you know, but is yours an origin story?
Dawn of the sleeper, yeah.
How did he get into that cave?
Who built the silo, man?
Yeah, it's sort of like, yeah, 127 hours meets Bumblebee. This is good stuff. We missed you on this podcast, Chris.
You have really good
energy. No, it's awesome to talk to Jesse. I think that his perspective at this moment was also fascinating because he finished work on this, you know, months ago, but he sort of had a couple of days now to marinate in the positive reaction, which, at least judging from his body language, has created a feeling of some relief. I think he seemed very calm. And no, it's a pleasure to talk to him because, you know, one of the reasons that the show is so deep and so good is because not only are he and his other writers so good, but they think very deeply about all of it.
Yeah, we won't, without any further ado, let's get into our conversation with Succession creator Jesse Armstrong. We were produced, as always, by upstart co-host of The Watch, Kaya McMullen. And we will be back on Monday, where I will be recording from Philadelphia, and then Thursday, reunited with my team back in Los Angeles.
Do you look at Kaya now the way that Shiv looks at Tom? Like, is that...
That's a complicated question.
Great point. There's a lot of shifting things in that. I guess I just mean, like, you know, you didn't see it coming.
No, you guys did such a... it's a wonderful conversation. People can also listen to Bill and Sean on the Prestige TV podcast. I know we've got some more kind of Succession content coming from both The Watch and from Prestige TV podcast. Andy and I maybe we'll chat a little bit more about Succession when we're in the same continental United States, huh?
Yeah, let's do it. But for now, let's just talk to the creator of the show about it. I feel like that's a much better look. So thank you again to Jesse for joining us, and let's get into it.
Andy and I are so thrilled, honored really, to be joined by Jesse Armstrong, the creator of Succession. He's been on the show multiple times, and now he's on probably for the last time talking about Succession. We hope not the last time ever. Jesse, congratulations on completing the season. I wanted to ask you to start the final images of the siblings that we see on the show. Kendall staring into oblivion, into the river. Roman enjoying a martini at the bar. Shiv, possibly in a loveless future made up for business reasons, a decision made for business reasons. What describes you best right now?
What of those three?
Yeah.
I think I'm closest to having a martini. So yeah, I'm in a good place.
That's good.
Have you spent the last few days, what is your process? Do you go dark on media, or have you been injecting the content into your veins, hearing what people thought about this finale?
In the past, I've tended to keep pretty clear of the stuff, just for sort of professional reasons of wanting to not have it too much in my head, to be talking mainly to my writer's room and not to the culture as a whole. But I'm one of the people in the world who's most interested in Succession. So I'm going to, I'm starting to read pieces and look at stuff. You can sometimes feel a bit filthy in a sort of rolling in your own shit way of like, there's something uncomfortable about it, but there's also something when you hear interesting stuff, read interesting stuff, that's like, yeah, this is great. People have been thinking about the show and we've been thinking about it, and some of it feels really nice. So I'm going to start looking at more stuff, I think.
Great. Well, we'll collate. We have a few blog posts. I know The Ringer has done one or two. So we'll send you a package to review. So we do have a bunch of questions, obviously, about the specifics of the finale. But I did want to take a more general tack at the beginning and ask you more broadly about when you knew it was time to bring the show to an end. There's been some reporting about this. I think Kieran did an interview where he said that he felt like you were hedging even at the final table read, saying, well, if there was a season five, this would have been it. Could you talk us through your own internal process? Is this something that you've known for a while, but you sort of felt loath to commit? Or was there a single scene or episode in the writing this season where you knew we've reached the point where it's time to end?
Yeah, I mean, it was really tough. I really love the show. I love the way that it lets me write and lets my fellow writers write and lets us collaborate. So it was a really tough decision. I was checking my sort of notebooks and my stuff, and it was actually, I started playing with season shapes when we were like in the edit of season three. So a long time ago, and like looking at what two final seasons would look like and looking what one final season would look like. And even then, two or three years back, it was the shape of it that went a couple of episodes, one where Logan is at the helm kind of, and then he passes away, and then a bunch of episodes that were more or less clear, and then an election, and then an ending where the company passes from family ownership. That's been it for a long time, long, long time. I guess what I tried to keep open was one thing, which is I like to go into the writer's room with a proposition, but not, it would be kind of a load of bullshit if I went in there and said, this is it. What would the writing room be for? So, and it's not that nothing ever changes in there, lots changes in there, but I like to test the proposition. So it was a proposition rather than a decision. And for a number of reasons, it felt right to not close the process off with my other group of collaborators who are the actors and directors. So I tried to signal, I don't know how successfully, that I thought this was the end from the beginning of from the first time we gathered. And obviously, that everyone knew that Logan died from pretty early. So I think that was another, pretty significant signal that we were getting near the end. So I tried to keep it open because I wanted to keep it open, because I think it felt important. It just felt honest that I hadn't totally, totally decided. If someone had managed to come up with some brilliant way that it carried on, I was kind of up for that. And maybe that's not completely useful to all my collaborators, but it was the truth. And so I knew and I tried to communicate that, but it felt honest to also say, it's not over till it's over. Is that a useful answer?
It is. Did someone come the closest to changing your mind?
I remember when we were leaving the writing room on the last day, we were closing up and we had the season, you know, broken. Lots changes once we start shooting. But I remember Will Tracy kind of going, huh, after those first two episodes, it kind of could have been the kids versus Logan. You know, the kids running Pierce, if they successfully bought it, and Logan running ATN, that would have been kind of a cool season. And as we were just, the door was kind of clicking and I didn't have a kind of like, yeah, we've done a good 4 months. Maybe we should start again. So that, you know, I think hopefully if it's a decent show, it has multiple different potential ways we could have written it. I don't wake up in the night and think, oh, fuck, we should have done a whole season of the kids against Logan. But it could have been fun.
I do wonder though, if this crossed your mind, or if this is the sort of thing that is easier to do in hindsight or for critics to do, but I thought one of the things that felt boldest about the season was the clear evidence that you could have kept going, that you know, there were more permutations, there were more versions of conflict between the characters that you've so brilliantly created. But ultimately, the fact that you could keep going was a bug, not a feature. Which, I mean, by that I mean that, like, being trapped on this sort of unfulfilling hamster wheel is the character's fate. And I feel like it would kind of diminish the impact of that if you chose a similar path on the creative side.
Yeah, I wouldn't like us to be like a marathon runner crossing the finish line and collapsing. That would not be a cool way for us to end the show, with every narrative possibility squeezed from the toothpaste tube of possibility. It was built in that, you know, like when a death happens, there's a future that where that death didn't happen, you know, for maybe days or hours or years. And so it was important to me and us that there was a real feeling of a narrative direction that then is interrupted by this. You know, he's in his mid-80s, so it's not such a surprising event, but deaths are still surprising when they come. So we wanted that interruption was very necessary from what we want to do creatively with that death.
You know, Jeremy did an interview with Vanity Fair where he was talking a bit. I think he described it, your worldview, as one where you don't think people change fundamentally, and that they, especially these characters, are sort of stuck in this cycle. And I was curious, sort of piggybacking on what Andy said, whether that cycle and whether that inability to change is another reason why the show needed to end. Because if you're not going to send Kendall out into the world of, you know, philanthropy, or if you're not going to, you know, sort of evolve these characters because of your sort of fundamental belief about who they are, does it wind up not limiting the way you write the show, but affecting the way you write the show?
It's a good point. I'd say a couple of things. First of all, I do think change is possible. I don't think people are immutably
who
they are.
That's a relief for me to hear. No, personally.
We can change. People do change. I think it happens slowly. It happens incrementally, usually. And it happens with difficulty. And it also happens that sometimes you don't develop opening up like a flower, but sometimes you wither like a weed that's been hit with some pesticide, right? People don't just get better. Sometimes they get worse. And, you know, the narrative structures we're mostly comfortable with is growth and burgeoning opportunities. And those can happen. I'm not like reductive. I don't have anything against a story about somebody who becomes other and gets better, but we don't see it that much in life. And especially in this sphere that we find ourselves in, with these people who are so trapped psychologically, orbiting this name, this power, this influence, this psychologically unattainable man who they both know is so damaging to them, but something inside them impels them to try and get closer to him again and again. So I do think change is possible. It's not evident much in these characters, but the circumstances around them change a lot, and so I think there is change, and you know, I think sometimes people kid themselves a little bit about how much change they want. You know, it's if Michael Corleone starts working inside the mafia, is that a change? It's always latent in him. If he ran off and joined the circus, then that would be, I think we said this before, that that would be a real change.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be, maybe it'd be an interesting movie. We might have found a good project, but the scope of change is small on a personal level. I think the washing machine of repetition that I was very eager not to get stuck in is actually the business one, because the moves that we could play on, you know, there's the psychological track and there's the business, financial, media track. And in a way, I think I could keep on thinking about interesting psychological ways for these characters to interact, if not change, but be put into new circumstances to see different facets of them. I think at a certain point, it's about a media empire and what happens to it on a gross level, but that gross framework is really important to the motor of the show. And I didn't want to overplay those beats until you were starting to wonder, you know, whether Kerry's brother would take over the company.
Right. I mean, that was the incredible thing about the finale for me, was just that I felt like there are some series finales that you feel like end, like the show has come to its conclusion. You found out what happened to the people on Lost, or you know, you see Don at the sort of New Age retreat. But I felt like with Succession, it was like we were being dropped off at the station as viewers, and that it's entirely possible that Kendall calls Shiv 30 minutes after the show ends. Maybe not, you know, I mean, like, but you leave it up to the viewers to sort of imagine where Roman goes after his martini, where Shiv and Tom go after that night. And it's got this kind of ellipsis rather than a hard stop, which is not so much a question as much as it's just, I really appreciated the way it ended.
Good. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It feels more full stoppy to me than that. I think it's just what the limit of my almost comprehension or interest, or maybe I think the honest truth is it may be the limit of the world's interest in those characters. Like once that company is gone, once you're, you know, a Disney, but Disney doesn't own Disney, you become a kind of curio in the elevated social world that these characters move in, rather than a powerful figure. And so maybe there is something reductive, but it's kind of like the world in the harshest version of that, kind of done with them. Like they've got their billions, but they're not actors anymore.
I thought that was actually one of the most powerful thoughts or emotions in that finale, is that everything dropped away and we saw what they were and we saw who we were watching the whole time. The circus, not the Corleone Brothers circus, which has been very successful for many years, but one of the lesser circuses, has left town. And what I was struck by at the end was this sort of sense that, oh, maybe we had been watching the wrong program for 4 years. That in the end, these were never, I mean, Logan was right. These were not serious people. We were watching a show about broken children, and the business of Waystar, of the future of it, was always happening in rooms we weren't in. You know, I remember talking, and maybe this came up in our last interview, that through large portions of season three, it felt like Logan's story, where he was actually doing the work to keep the company alive, was off screen, along with his relationship with Kerry, along with the things that seemed to matter in the larger shareholder view of Waystar Royco. And just, we were with these kids fighting over the broken Legos. And this finale disabused us of the idea that we were ever watching Titans of Industry. You know, this is that in many ways, once the framework went away, the psychological story, as you put it, was what you were telling, and it came to a close.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it was important for me to live in this certain duality that I knew what I thought would happen in the final episode, and it did. But I guess the only caveat I would have is that I don't think any of them would probably have been good at running the company, but it wouldn't be impossible. Like things that could happen, I think it would be not good, but I'm not sure that anyone can save this legacy media company.
I personally really wanted to see what Roman did to cinema, honestly. I mean, it was all out in front of us there. Calispatron had a lot of meat on the bone.
I think this whole strike we're embroiled in would have been resolved by now due to his, you know, sensitivity towards the creative spirit and mind.
I wouldn't like to see him in the negotiating room, I think, yeah.
Or on the picket lines. He doesn't do well in large protests. I wonder, Jesse, that your perspective on the way that this finale was greeted and the buildup to it, because one thing that I found surprising, but rubbed me the wrong way as a fan of the show, I think, was this sort of narrative that there were winners and losers, that who is going to win? Who's going to win this show? And it struck me as that, and I wondered, not to put words in your mouth, if this struck you as a very American sensibility, that we should be rooting for these titans of industry, or that someone could come out on top, and that this is not a poison chalice that they're struggling to inherit at the end of the day?
No, I think it would be a bit disingenuous to like write a show called Succession and have everyone wondering and talking about constantly who would take over, and then to profess like, oh, you shouldn't be interested in that.
That's fair.
I think you're right on a deeper level. If you were solely watching the show for that element, I think you'd find it not a very satisfying watch. It'd basically be a load of insults and who's going to win. And maybe it's enjoyable on that level. Similarly, I have a twin track on that. Like, I was interested in that. It had to feel right, and Tom felt right and intriguing and true to the world. But you're right in that isn't the ending. That I think if you think of what the ending of this show was, it wasn't like, oh, Tom was the best and Tom won. It was something more complicated than that. But I wouldn't dismiss that element of it. I was, you know, interested to hear what people thought, and I wouldn't disdain anyone for their theories about who was going to win, because I can't help thinking about like that about shows.
I just love the idea of you with your writers in London, kind of having Trojan horsed yourself successfully into this country's psyche, and wondering just what your perspective on that on that was, especially during the writing of this last season. I found it very interesting that the person who quote unquote does win is the most American. He's dismissed as being provincial just, you know, two episodes earlier. He describes his job as a pain sponge who's just going to be up all night worrying, which kind of, that's an American work ethic for good or ill. I wondered what that was like for you guys to be an ocean away and to be, you know, right in the corporate boardroom of this kind of fucked up country.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of Americans on the show, cast and writers, and so we're at least Anglo-American as in our perspective.
It's a special relationship.
It's true.
That's very kind of you to say, and we'd all be very pleased over here. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be too disdainful. I'm not disdainful. I did American studies. I'm a sort of, I like America a lot. I like people and I like being there. I like New York City. I like a lot of about America. And, you know, if I had to sum up my feelings, I would probably be along the lines of Kendall when he's sort of incredibly gauche and says, all the different people living together, it's a nice idea. I think it is a nice idea. And it's still, I find, you know, a very persuasive idea and a nice way of being a nation. However, yeah, I think I was away. You know, I used to come to America for 6 months at a time to make the show. It was hard. I was off, away from my family. It was dislocating. And I think I find this even more when I'm in LA. I get a slightly pleasant sense of disassociation, that kind of, you know, we all know it, the feeling of coming home from away and noticing everything afresh, and you know, you do it when you go into a different culture or a different city, and everything seems very vivid, and the stuff which the people who live there have stopped noticing is very obvious to you. And that's, you know, whatever we think satire is, one of the things it is taking a rather cold look at what you're looking at, right? That's one of the things you do. You try to strip away a little bit, and that's why it can be uncomfortable for the subject. So yeah, I think being not from there, being from a already dissolved empire, watching one which is, who knows, we might be a long way from that moment, or sometimes it feels you're right in the middle of it. So yeah, it's certainly been a perspective that lots of the writers have shared as we've worked.
I was reading a piece that went up on The Guardian that you wrote about the sort of influences on Succession, the sort of origin story of doing the show and bringing it to Los Angeles and meeting Adam and working on it. And I was struck by just how many, you know, obviously real life figures you were drawing on. I think you mentioned the Murdochs, obviously, Robert Maxwell, the Redstones. And you take that and you combine it with the thing that leaps out at me and that always grabs me by the brain, I guess, is the sort of shades of this, as many people point out, like the Shakespearean elements of the show. And Jeremy has spoken about the Richard III elements. And you know, I saw somebody compare the Roman Kendall hug to something that happens in Wolf Hall. And there's all these great moments. I wonder what of you was in Succession, you know, like almost on an autobiographical level. But, you know, sometimes when I'm watching it, there's things that happen on the show. Andy and I talked about it, especially when it came to Logan's death, where it's like, this happened to somebody in that writer's room, you know, or there's things that happen in this show that aren't in a biography and they're not in Henry VIII. They're real, you know?
Well, Henry VIII never flew, I believe, in an airplane. So that true. Definitely wasn't good there. Well, I'm going to eliminate that.
One thing on his bucket list he didn't get to, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I've occasionally thought about this, people have brought up that I'm pretty seem different from the characters in the show and stuff. I think there's a way in which it's anti-biography and that I grew up not in London and not near power, not near money. And I'm personally, I like cordial relations and I like warm familial relations in family and in work. And so in a way you could say it's like a anti-biography. These are all the things which I find fascinating and which are not a part of my life. I worked in politics and I've now been around media and have seen money and so on. And so I feel like I've got a feel for some of that stuff, but you know, maybe it's slightly the witchcraft of trying to keep it away in that I find it fascinating to see people who can be brutal. I, you know, value probably truth and trying to tell the truth very highly. And these are people for whom it's a contingent tactic. So that's the way I think about that. I think a little bit, but also the writer's room is a generous, I hope, sort of you know, rather warm and woozy and cuddly place where at some points where we do talk about difficult things that have happened to ourselves and my fellow writers share and I try and share. And so a lot of stuff gets put into the communal pool for us to draw on for those affecting moments.
I want to talk about some of those affecting moments, as you put it, because I think that you and your writers are rightfully lauded for the cleverness and the insults and the swearing. But one of the things that dazzled me episode after episode was the almost relentless mining of the emotional possibilities within pre-existing relationships, that there always felt like there was more meat on the bone, so to speak, and you could keep going back to it. So I wondered if we could talk specifically about Shiv and Tom, which is just seemed like, you know, non-Daniel Plainview types might think that well was dry, but no, it kept producing season after season. You know, we may have talked about this 2 years ago, but when they're sitting on that beach and Tom says, you know, maybe I would just be a little less sad, I was like, well, that's done. That's the most perfect conversation these two can ever have. And then season after season, you would have more to say. And then this season, there was no floor, you know, in terms of how low they could go with each other. So specifically thinking of those characters and the opportunities that came up in the room, how did you approach finding new avenues and new places for it to go and still have them be true?
Well, I guess like a lot of the season, it was useful to know that this was the end. And so I've always encouraged us to like use our ammunition now and worry about the new supplies tomorrow, you know, because you never know if you're going to get to, I don't want to carry on my analogy now, I've ended up in a foxhole, but you know, spend it while you got it, because you never know, it might not be the right moment the next time. But knowing that it was the end, it was rather distinct to me. There was a period where they hadn't talked about what happened in Italy, and that felt very real big to me, because when we talked about it in the room, it felt like, yeah, you know what, this is, it's so you know, it's so disempowering that night to Shiv. What does she do? She doesn't tell Tom right away that she knows what's happened. And it felt incredibly credible to me that she wouldn't, because it put her back there. So there's that period when they hadn't talked about it. There was some, you know, as Tom progresses, there was that moment we got where we were, where he felt sufficiently emboldened to talk about the truth of why he was with Shiv, which is complicated and multi-layered, but he said the hard things as well as the easy things. And then we always knew that we wanted it for them to say, to have that row that you think is going to be the one from which you can never come back. And so we always knew that was going to be laid in. And then for me, they end in a place of a certain rather terrifying, cool equality. And so I do believe what you say, in that if somebody had to go and write a play about Tom and Shiv from the writing room or me, I think we could carry on. But we did, I think we went to the places that were most interesting in this season in the relationship, in that kind of structure.
It's very interesting though, what you just said, that in your mind, that final shot is one of equality, that they've ended in the same place as equals for the first time. Is that a correct read of what you were saying?
Yeah, for me, there's an emotional equality that they've never shared, because Tom has always been subordinate, or he's been in that role in a relationship where there's something essentially where he's trying to please her or get her validation. And that, because of the material change between them, has altered. And yet she retains that queenly name and that, you know, plutocrat's money. And whereas he's, you know, he'll probably get his share option soon, but he's still something of a salary man. And so there's a haughty respect on both sides, I would say, for me. And, you know, I used to be really reticent about putting a name on the quality, on the nature of these scenes and stuff. I used to feel it was transgressing on the kind of the right of the viewer to make their own assessment. But now it's all done, I feel like, you know what, people make their own assessments. It's probably a bit self-regarding to think they're going to change them because I've said what I think the situation is.
But I love hearing that, because there's such a formality to the way in which they hold hands in the back of the car, and it looks like they're in a throne room. And when you think about so many royal unions, they're about political expediency or like accumulation of political power. And so it does make sense that, you know, I think that you could watch that and you could say, oh, Shiv has sort of bent the knee and now is kind of subservient to Tom. But I think that there is, you're right, that there's a balance there. She says something to him earlier in the episode about, you know, once you've said the worst things to someone, that you're free, that it frees you up a little bit. And I think that her kind of proclamation there gets obviously stress tested in the conference room when she's there with Roman and Kendall. And even in this series where so many things have been said and so many things have been done, it felt like Shiv reminding Kendall, who I suppose needed reminding, that he is a murderer, and that Roman going that extra foot and saying, you know, if you want to talk about bloodline, it should be Shiv. Those two felt like lines or ideas that you had been hanging on to, and like, this will be in the final showdown. Is that true? Or because those feel like things that's very difficult to come back from.
Yeah, I got caught up thinking about what you were saying first. The only thing I would add to the Tom and Shiv thing is I don't think it's not like good equality. It's like,
oh yeah,
it's like 1984 USSR USA equality, right? It's mutually assured destruction. Like there's a bit in that I think Matthew has talked about in the stage directions about them being like bombs in transit. And I don't think it's like equality they can build on. It's that, you know, you sometimes see in a political or showbiz marriage, a rather frozen, terrifying.
A stalemate.
It's a stalemate.
You're saying more
exactly.
Of like a Sylvester Stallone, Dolph Lundgren kind of union, you know, at the end of Rocky.
That's it. That's
yeah.
it.
Did they end up holding hands? I don't remember the movie that well.
It's the director's cut. I'll show it to you later. Yeah. Yeah.
But your second part of your question was about what they say in the, in that,
in the conference room. Yeah. Cause I would imagine you'd have to, there has to be.
And you mentioned two bits. You meant, which bits did you mention?
It was Shiv saying, reminding Kendall that he killed someone, and yes. Roman then making the comment about the sort of validity of the bloodline going through, yes. which is such a classical statement to make, but is
yes.
that Shiv has sort of more right to the throne because she'll have this natural child.
Yeah, the first one was the one that was laid in that we kind of knew that if it was raised and Kendall, you know, from expediency, tried to brush it away in a what turns out to be rather a foolish way, some glue that stuck them together would come undone forever, and that would be the thing which means he you know that the argument is over at that point. They're not interested in listening to him because he's betrayed this thing that they seem to share that was quite deep. The bloodline, I didn't know was going to come up, I think even maybe until I was writing it, and then it suddenly kind of, it's one of those things that reared up. My fellow writers may came to mind me and say that was not wrong, but I don't think that was on our little card for that scene, but it was like, oh yeah, that's in there. And, you know, there's been various times where his generation's rather brutal, reductive way of looking at things, and maybe, you know, more than his generation, that kind of regal, you know, horrible checking of virginity and bloodlines and bastard sons and that stuff suddenly asserts itself in a horrible way.
One of the things that Chris and I have loved so much about watching the show and talking about the show week to week is that we've had this much time to do it, that this has been a ongoing, as we've learned, all shows are actually limited series, but at least we had multiple seasons to watch these characters grow and develop and watch you and your creative team grow and develop in tandem. If we were talking to an actor, I would imagine that an actor would say to sign up for a multi-year project like this involves a degree of trust that the stewards of the ship will be guiding them in the right direction. Stewards of the yacht in this particular case. I'm curious about it from your perspective about the relationships with the actors. And specifically, I wanted to bring up Kieran, who I thought his performance this year was really astonishing. And I imagine that years ago when you cast him in the pilot and he's playing this character who's very much surface and, you know, and the bad boy and behaving in the way that he is, that there must have been discussions between the two of you about what that was hiding, about what was beneath the surface in the iceberg. And things have come out over the years and we learned about his character history and we've seen his behaviors in various pairings. I wondered about the trust involved in this year where he would become basically install a fascist president in America and then fall all the way down to the bottom, you know, and with what happened at the funeral, with what happened in the street, and then where he ended up in the finale. Specifically about that journey with Kieran and that character.
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's been wonderful to work with these actors over the years and discover what they can do. And just, I've never hesitated for a moment writing a script thinking, will X person be able to get to this place? And sometimes with lots of words and sometimes with rather few words. So that's an incredible luxury as a writer to just know that you're dealing with a partner in an actor and all these actors who can literally go anywhere. There are no limits on what they can do in terms of verbal dexterity, but also emotional capacity. And specifically with Kieran, yeah, we, with Brian, obviously, and with Matthew and Jeremy, Kieran and Sarah, I think I sketched out what I thought would happen to their characters in the season early on. I had a chat with each of them. And so they have that kind of rope to feel for as we go through the season and it's that pitch is not immutable. That changes in usually in smaller ways. The shape of all their seasons, I think, remain the same. But Kieran was happy. I think he said in interviews he was, you know, one of the people who had maybe more doubts about signing up to a TV show where he didn't know where he was going, and he had certain anxieties, as anyone would, I think, about like, what the hell am I going to be doing for all these years potentially? And he also had anxieties about the improvisation, and you know, he took to that unbelievably well, and also the thing which he is able to do, which is to load up a bunch of our alternative lines and edit them and spit them out either on one take or multiple takes. So yeah, he was aware of where he was going, and I think he liked it.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details. One of the things that Andy obviously mentioned there was his role in the presidential election, which
yes.
Is an episode that I think is going to stay with people, especially in America, for quite some time. You've talked about this show and its relationship to Trump and being written in the aftermath of Trump's election and kind of coming to power. Mencken, to me, though, felt like more of a prophecy than a reflection. We don't really have someone specifically like him. Can't wait, but we don't just yet.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. There's certain people that he reminds me of, but nobody quite like him. Can you tell me a little bit about where he comes from for you and how much of that is Justin Kirk specifically, and how much of it is, what was the inspiration, I guess, if that's the right word, for such a demon?
Good. I think he is... You know, a bunch of it is interacting with Justin's persona and his, you know, the writing towards him and then him also bending the words towards what he does well. It's not a prophecy, I don't think. There's always an issue for this show, right, which we are close to reality, but if we touch it, we might get electrocuted because we can't get... If it got too close to reality, the audience's sense of the show would start to ask questions which would not help them be, you know, have willing suspension of disbelief. So we have to be really careful with that gap. But if we get too far away, for me, I lose interest. It's no longer has that relationship with the world, which I think is for me what gives it interest and power. And so when you have these political figures, I think really what we wanted was something that felt possible, was coherent. I guess he's got maybe low tax instincts, but with that vocabulary of more social provision that we're seeing quite a lot in that particular part of the Republican Party, Trumpy. And then he turns up the ethnic nationalism to, you know, to the dog whistle is really screaming. So I guess that's the ballpark. And yeah, we talked about a bunch of political figures who could be in that territory. I hope he's believable, but I hope he's not elected.
Right.
And yeah, the only other thing to say about that is I felt, especially as a British person writing into this culture and trying to take it seriously, it was important that we didn't say who won. You know, it's still in the courts as it would be in such a situation. And I would have felt uncomfortable saying that either he won or he didn't. It just felt wrong to me and somewhat, I guess, disrespectful to the gravity of the real moment, which is, it's sort of like climate change, right? You can forget how real the possibility of some people who don't believe in a peaceful transfer of power how close they are to winning in a national election in the US. It's like you keep on having to, you know, I do keep on having to slap my head and think this could happen. And I guess it's so real and scary if it were to happen. I wanted to take us out of that arena in terms of our fiction.
Just some patriots taking a stroll in Washington, D.C. on a winter day. I don't know what you're talking about. I wanted to just steer us to two specific scenes in the finale, if we could, that will linger for a while, and also really speak to something that was really brought home by the finale writ large, which was just that these three siblings really only make sense together, and their level of, you know, the familiarity of their mutual abuse is probably the only constant that makes them feel safe in a terrible way. The first moment was when they are doing they didn't get the medals, but they were going through the house with the stickers, and suddenly, you know, they stumble upon this video of a dinner where they see a vision of their father that makes them quite emotional, and they feel very fondly to him. And I'm not sure if it's playing on their faces that this is very much an event they weren't invited to, and a side of him that they weren't able to see. I wondered if you could talk us through that process of giving us another glimpse of Logan, but also that specific glimpse with that group of people behaving in that way.
Yeah, it was an instinct that such a thing might potentially be playing an event like that, where you're distributing, or, you know, seeking to distribute the effects of a deceased person. And honestly, I thought it might be a bit saccharine, a bit lacrimose. And I thought, we'll have it playing in the background and we'll kind of see what happens. Once the actors started responding, I remember on the day, I think I was in tears. I think Mark Mylod was as well. We were in tears when they shot it in the first place. Partly it was the show wrap for Brian and a bunch of other people, but also it was just very affecting. And then when seeing the kids react to it was even more affecting. So it suddenly became evident that, I guess it's something maybe, you know, that there aren't many moments, there aren't a huge number of moments in the show where those billionaires seem like people one knows. But a lot of us have seen tape of loved ones who've gone, and it's a gut punch, and it's one that I guess it's pretty obvious what they're thinking as they watch.
The second scene is, and I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, I've read that this was the last scene that maybe you filmed, which is the siblings with a meal fit for a king.
Yeah.
And the blender and we heard Jeremy actually drank it, which tracks. I guess I just was curious your thoughts now that it's in the past, of the particular dynamic between those three characters and the three actors, you know, because there has been, I think, too much ink spilled, and we won't contribute to it, about people's varying acting styles and approach to the material. But our takeaway, I think, as we've talked about this season, is whatever was happening worked, because the dynamic between those three individuals was so compelling and so surprising. And yet so it felt true, which is a strange thing to say about fictional characters, but there it was. And to see them at what could have been their happiest and what they could have been was really moving. And I guess I wondered about that on a character level and also on a personal level, being in that room with those actors playing those parts together for what may have been the last time.
Yeah, it's very emotional. I mean, you know, I don't want to go on about it too much. Everyone leaves different workspaces and, you know, people you won't see again for a while. It's not the grandest thing ever, but for us it was a big deal. They what can I say about them in that kitchen? It was delightful. It was a little heady. It was still basically the script, but it was extraordinarily funny. I could watch Kieran lick cheese, I think, probably for a whole show's worth, and do his Cockney accent. And yeah, it was, what can I say about it that transmits what it was like? It was, yeah, I think it was a little bit electric, not, you know, it was difficult to control, and there was a great energy. And I'm very glad that that was our last scene that we shot, rather than, I mean, it's just happenstance, maybe Christo and Mark Mylod arranged it to end on that high note. Probably they did, and I wasn't even aware. But it could have been another way. But it was very nice that in a certain way, in a kind of colleague-y way, that's where the show ended. Rather,
it's a version
than
of an ending.
But it's interesting, I think, the way throughout our conversation today, and I think even in past years, you do refer to the electricity or the surprise, and there's some improvisational aspects to the show. And I feel like that's a little bit underrated, not just in the terms of Kieran can put new fucks into certain formulations and they work and they make it into the show, but that you had this incredible both trust in your cast and production team, but also almost luxury of letting it tell you something on the day. I feel like that's not necessarily the norm, particularly for shows that we often, you know, that we laud and celebrate for the crisp writing. And, you know, the fact that these three actors were so comfortable both in these parts that you created for them and in their internal their dynamic as the three of them, that you could just let it go and see where it took you. I think that's not remarked upon enough. I don't think that's common.
No. And thank you. I think it's good. It comes from a bunch of places. You know, I learned a bit with Armando on Thick of It and In the Loop and Veep. And we got it also from Adam McKay, who shot the pilot and, you know, works like that and infused us from the very first day. We got it from Mark Mylod, who is able to marshal a lot of different ideas from cast and writers and my fellow writers and myself about what we feel. And he, you know, is like a global brain, being able to process it all and then turn it also into shootable, beautiful scenes. So there's all that going on as the backstory. And then, yeah, I mean, also it's worth saying there's this strike right on right now. I'm on strike and the whole WGA is, and we're on set. You know, on that day, there's me, Tony and Lucy, Preble, Tony Roach. We're on set, and yeah, we trust the actors implicitly, and they know their character and they can do what they want. But then there's us three and Mark to talk to them to make sure that it fits with the show and that, you know, if something could be, we could express something a little more cleanly or a little more messily, then we're there to change it. And sometimes the actors do that on their own, and sometimes we're there to help it. And sometimes we're just dead on script. But the fact that the actors know it's okay to go a different way. And sometimes I might say, oh, I really like that phrasing, let's hit that. But often I won't, it's a very good way to work for me with a couple of cameras. So you can always, you know, well, the editors do a hell of a lot of work to make sure that we then can cut it together, because people aren't necessarily always standing in the same place when they do what they don't necessarily do twice in a row.
I do think we will say this in our intro as well, and we probably should have said it earlier, that that yes, members of the WGA are on strike right now, as you are, and you know, this whole interview was done without the mechanisms of the state that you were very kind to connect with us via electronic mail, and this is
there now, are no Carolinas involved in the production.
No, this is now apparently okay, as I think it should be, because I mean there are few testaments to the importance of writers with the stature of Succession at this moment. So I'm glad to be able to talk to a writer during this strike.
We don't want to take up too much more of your time, Jesse, but I did want to ask.
Well, he's finished his show.
Yeah, you're done.
I'm going to be, if there's a podcast out, I'm going to be on there banging on about Succession till no one wants to hear about it anymore.
You're going to be doing Succession conventions and stuff.
I am.
I wanted to know what the end of this show means for you in terms of what you consume and what you're interested in about the world, and whether or not now that you're done with the world of mergers and acquisitions and captains of industry and, you know, heirs to thrones, et cetera, do you get really into the Premier League again? Can you kind of wash this off of you, or are these things that you think will interest you, consume you, fascinate you in your professional and personal life going forward?
Yeah. I mean, you should try, you know, there's nothing like writing a script to make you check out the transfers for your favorite soccer team. So yeah, no, that's kept pretty strong throughout. Yeah. There's a certain sort of shedding of skin of like, I won't necessarily read that whole piece about Shari Redstone or, you know, Comcast that's coming out, but probably I probably will, because I'm still interested in that world. The bit that is almost like there's something slightly hallucinatory about it. I'd encourage everyone to start reading the business pages a bit more closely, because once you've had your eyes opened to sound vaguely conspiracy theory-y, but it's like once you start looking at the ways that financial deals order the world, you can't stop looking at it. And, you know, I've been at HBO while AT&T bought it for like mid-80s billion dollars. And then it's sold to Discovery for mid-40s billion dollars. And it's not like quite like $40 billion disappeared, because AT&T shareholders hold some of that stock. But it's also not completely not like $40 billion disappeared. And you know, people I've worked with lose their jobs, and they it's a bit like, one salary is a tragedy, 1,000 is a statistic. You see these extraordinary sums of money appear and disappear. And it's not like, you know, when you're stoned and 18 and you think none of this is real, they could just put different zeros on the end and we could all be living in luxury. But it's very hard to comprehend how those decisions impact people's lives. And it's difficult to look away once you start looking at the movements of business which affect our lives.
To be fair, $40 billion disappeared, but I think 11 other creators of Succession appeared in one of these transitions, right? So there is a trade-off. I also feel like I should apologize. I feel like I've been trying to lock you into this role of being a British observer of all of this, which is it's far too limiting. But I do think that one of the most American things, one of the things that Americans are not good at is leaving well enough alone. So I do feel like the decision to say, I've told my story and I'll have other opportunities and other stories to tell. I don't know if it's particularly British, but it feels foreign and it feels quite exciting, honestly. And I wonder if that is that specific to you, do you think? And because you have a restless creative mind and you're ready to do something else, or is it partly connected to the fact that your career already has had so many twists and turns and time spent with different creative partnerships and relationships and different styles of shows across genres, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, maybe there's something deep in like the TV or creative culture you grow up in. You know, obviously UK has not had as much money, and historically we've made these, you know, single writer, six episode runs of sitcoms and dramas at six or eight. And, you know, if you've grown up working on a show which is 22, 23 or more in a season, that must get coded into your sense of what it's like to do a TV show at a certain level. And if you've grown up, you know, thinking of Fawlty Towers and The Office, just, you know, doing two or three seasons and that being enough, maybe that gets coded in. I think more, you know, there's a lot of tough decisions to make in this show, cutting pieces of script I love, stories I love, rewriting things which are kind of already working, but I think need more, which is can be complicated, and losing material of brilliant actors doing brilliant stuff, which doesn't fit into your hour or into a compact story shape. So I feel like I've got inured to difficult decisions, and I think I've always honored what is best for this story, or what I think is best, and that's all I can do. And so once the idea had occurred to me that I thought that this was it, if that's like a little brain weevil you can't get rid of, because, you know, can you imagine trying to write another season when you're like, oh, this is the season we didn't really need to do, but it was so fun to hang out, and, you know, we're going to go to these couple of cool locations, which is something I've always also not wanted to influence our decisions. So yeah, it's I don't know, there may be a bunch of reasons why we've done maybe fewer than you might have expected, but runs are maybe getting a bit shorter overall, right?
Also, you have this robust succession convention circuit to start.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to get into hanging those, out.
I'm stitching those costumes.
The Conhead convention. It's got to happen soon.
Like the Ortolan snack bar. I think it's going to be great. We could pitch you on this all day, but yeah. We probably shouldn't.
Jesse, thank you so much for spending time with us. Thank you so much for this television program, which Andy and I adored and spent so much time talking about. But I think I speak for Andy when I say the great thing about this show is not just thinking about the show, but all the other things it made me think about, you know, and it's really incredible to have something so stimulating, and you should be really proud.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad you felt it's worthy of your time. And that's, you know, it's all I wanted really is something that Hulk is worthy of holding your interest. And so I'm that's kind.
It was a joy. And please take all the time off you need because we're on strike. But then when that's over, please come back. Please give us something new soon.
Enjoy
and
transfer rumors.
Thank you
so much.
Thank
you, gents. It's a pleasure chatting with you. Cheers.